I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Dr. Bridget McCandless is retiring as the president and CEO of the Health Forward Foundation, a position she's held since 2013. But the McCandless story is so much more than that. Today, we'll talk with one of the most influential healthcare advocates in the metro. We'll ask Dr. McCandless where it came from, look back at her career serving those in need, and ask what she sees as her greatest challenges and accomplishments. Then he was a world champion and one of the most written about sports figures of his day. Yet when I say trailblazing black athlete, Major Taylor is most likely not the name that comes to mind. We'll learn more about this sports star who broke barriers before Jackie Robinson. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Bridget McCandless is hanging it up, not that her passion for basic health care for the underserved is going away. Bridget is stepping down as the CEO of the Health Forward Foundation, formerly known as the Healthcare Foundation of Kansas City, that does important work in the area when it comes to funding mental health and vital health care. Its work is funded by the $400 million in proceeds that resulted from the sale of Health Midwest to HCA, Inc. back in 2003. Bridget took the reins from Steve Rowling in 2013, but is leaving to, as she says, help her parents age gracefully. Leaving, though, is one of the toughest decisions she's ever had to make. Now an exit interview from one of the most influential healthcare leaders in the metro. Bridget, welcome back. So nice to have you here.
So good to be with you, Steve.
Just how tough is it to step away?
You know, I'd say bittersweet. It is joyful to think about the work that the foundation does and the growth that we've been able to see in both Kansas City Health and the organizations who serve the vulnerable people of our community. So that part gives me great joy. I will miss the work, but I won't be disappearing. I will continue to be a troublemaker in some way.
Is that what Health Forward does? Is it focused on the underserved, Bridget? Give us a sense.
The hospitals that were sold served a variety of people and in across demographics. But when the Attorney General formed the foundation, it was really designed to be able to take care of the people who were the most vulnerable. So in our mission statement, it says the underserved and uninsured. And we have looked at that as an important aspect of the work that we do.
How much in assets do you have right now, just roughly?
We have about $750 million in assets, and from that we have to generate the money that we give in grants. We've given almost $280 million in grants since the foundation started giving money away in 2005.
So you basically give away what the investments spin off each year. Do I understand that right?
Correct. So our investments have to make money for us to give money and also for us to be able to manage the operations of the foundation. So we have to satisfy both sides of those.
So the assets originally from the sale amounted to about $400 million. Is that amount just simply grown over the years? Is that what I'm gathering here?
Well, we're fortunate that it's been a market that has treated the foundation assets very well. But the foundation also went through a period where we had a lawsuit, and that was settled favorably for the foundation, and that added to the corpus.
How much money, then, do you spend in any given year? Just roughly, what's the amount?
We're roughly spending about $20 million in our grant side each year. We also work hard on advocacy. While that isn't a lot of money, it's important on the impact that the foundation has beyond just its grant making.
And how much leeway does the board have when it comes to deciding who gets what money? Is it all their decision?
You know, we have an incredibly talented staff who does nothing but work with our grantees every day. So they bring a really valuable perspective to the board, as well as some of the external resources that we bring in to help us review grants. We bring in reviewers from around the entire country to help us think about where the best way, how the best use of those dollars are. So we use the expertise of both our internal staff, that external review process, with final approval by the board of directors.
All right, how many different organizations might get a grant in a given year? I'm sure it varies, but just roughly.
We have about 150 grant organizations organizations that are active with the foundation right now. Some of those may have more than one grant at a time working on different aspects of health and wellness. So probably about 250 active grants.
Bridget McCandless is my guest. She's the president and CEO of the Health Forward Foundation, formerly known as the Healthcare Foundation of Kansas City. If you have a question for Bridget, our number 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. You talked in your farewell letter about your decision being steeped in my dedication to my parents. They must be pretty special people.
Oh, I have the most wonderful parents. I will tell you that I was blessed to have a social justice upbringing that I think got me ready for the work that I have been privileged to get to do at the foundation and previously in my service. I ran a free health clinic. So that I think that background heavily influenced by my parents.
A social justice upbringing. What do you mean by that?
I will tell you that I had the most unique set of friends as a child. My parents did prison ministry, so I probably spent enough time in maximum security penitentiaries that I could get off on time served at this point. But my parents also worked in domestic violence, in issues related to poverty. So really very thoughtful and wonderful people.
Were they ministers of churches or just lay people, or how did that work?
You know, my parents both worked in the health field. My father has a PhD in pharmacology and taught it at KCUMB, the osteopathic med school, for 30 years. And my mother was a nurse, but it was part of their Catholic service to be part of community and to put that faith into action.
What did you think of those maximum security prisons?
Well, you know, I was a little kid.
Me,
it was just something that we did on Tuesday nights, was to be able to go visit people who did not have families who were able to visit them. And so I had a unique set of experiences that I will treasure. It was a way for my parents to remind me that people come from a variety of circumstances and that there is good in all. So a beginning place for me to start that journey.
I was going to say, what is the takeaway from an experience like that when you spend time with folks in those circumstances? And I'm always struck at the time I've spent on death row or whatever, interviewing folks there. You know, you walk away and you realize that at least for a good chunk of them, they're real people too, just like the rest of us. You know, it's an interesting perspective to sort of come face to face with.
I think some of the work in the foundation around trauma, about the impacts of those early insults on kids, moving frequently, neighborhood violence, death of someone in the family, loss of a parent, all of those are really setting up a framework for how people begin to interact with others, how they approach problem solving, how they approach risk, and we are knowing more and more about brain development with those early traumas, how that affects juvenile justice system, how that affects the education system, how that affects people's life expectancy. And I think seeing people on the far end of that extreme helped me be even more appreciative about what environment we have for children as they are growing up and what expectations we have for them as they move through the various aspects of their life. How do we support that well? How do we build environments that make people safely move through all of the evolution that you do as a person?
Right. I'm just wondering about the east side of Kansas City and the trauma that so many families are enduring there on a daily basis, on a nightly basis. How has the Healthcare Foundation Health Forward dealt with that kind of challenge?
You know, gun violence is such a monstrous issue that I think that you're having foundations think about it and city officials think about it. And we're obviously having that discussion at the national level. You know, violence isn't distributed equally. 13% of the population are African American, and yet 51% of the homicide victims are African American. Mm-hmm. And so thinking about how you put your resources in ways that we can give people alternatives to making choices where you end up with someone who dies by homicide. We're investing in a variety of ways. We're investing in domestic violence shelters. We are investing in mental health and well-being of children. We're investing in conflict resolution. We are working on mental health with kids in schools. So many different aspects, but I don't tell you in any way that we really know the answer to how we affect gun violence in Kansas City, other than to say that this is not the problem of just Black people. It is not just the problem of poor people. It is an issue that requires the attention and dedication of an entire community, because it has effects on an entire community.
Are you seeing the entire community paying attention to this and responding in ways that you think are helpful, or do we have a ways to go on that front?
Oh, I think we have a long ways to go. It mm-hmm. is easy to think that it is someone else's problem, but poverty, opportunity, education, access, feeling that you are connected, that you have a sense of belonging, that matters everywhere. But it is important that we invest as an entire community in being sure that those opportunities extend to everyone. I think that has a lot to do with where you see concentrated gun violence. You also see concentrated poverty.
You know, as you describe that, it brings to mind this idea that dealing with gun violence in Kansas City is a multifaceted, it's a more complex kind of issue than a lot of people want it to be. Am I seeing that correctly? Do you view it that way?
I do. I think that it is a very complicated problem, which is part of the reason that we've had such a very difficult time dealing with it. That also doesn't let us off the hook. And I think that we have an opportunity to make this the place that we would like to live. Yeah. And that requires an investment of time, energy, and focus from everyone.
Is your time, energy, and focus from Health Forward, is it devoted strictly to the Kansas City Metro? Does it extend beyond that, Bridget? What's your coverage area?
So the foundation's coverage area was designed by the Attorney General. It was the location of the hospitals that were sold in the original agreement. So we have three counties in Missouri and three counties in Kansas: Jackson, Cass, and Lafayette on the Missouri side, mm-hmm. and Johnson, Wyandotte, and Allen County on the Kansas side. Mm-hmm. So we have about 1.8 million people in the catchment area for the foundation. So that gives us two legislatures to pay attention to and a myriad of municipalities. But it also gives us great opportunity to think about health in a variety of ways, depending mm-hmm. on the community that we're working with at the time.
Describe for us, if you would, the work the foundation is doing in the mental health arena. What direction have you gone there?
So mental health is very broad. You know that it is across the entire age spectrum. It is also all the way from prevention, all the way through treatment, and people really trying to think about how you best serve people early in their condition, as well as people who need medications or other kinds of supports. So the foundation has invested in, for example, supporting new moms as they have babies, screening them for depression early on so that you are making sure that children grow up in an excellent environment. We've done quite a bit of investing in school-based mental health services and supports for children there. One of the things that I'm very happy about is that the foundation helped encourage the state of Missouri to think about allowing Medicaid services to be delivered on site at schools. Mm-hmm. So it didn't require legislative action. It really only required some redefinition at the executive level. And that's the kind of extension of work the foundation can look at for long term. We also worked hard on the Children's Services Tax, so an opportunity to have monies dedicated to the health and well-being for children in Jackson County. And then that's money that the foundation doesn't have to put out of its coffers. We have a bigger pool to draw from.
You know, people think of the foundation and they think of all the resources that you have. I'm thinking you give away, said, $20 million last year. You could give away 3, 4, 5, 10 times that amount. I mean, if you could wave a magic wand, you'd still have need after that amount of giving away money, right?
Absolutely. We are already getting 3 to 4 times the request that we have money to give. And in part, we are seeing an abundance of fabulous ideas coming forward. The growth of the kinds of requests that we get the sophistication, the partnerships, the collaboration has just been absolutely encouraging. I think Kansas City is far ahead of the nation in those collaborative efforts. This is not a place where people are cutthroat about getting grant funding. They really are looking at how do we do this together? Who's the best person to lead this work? How can we be complementary? So there are great things for Kansas City to be incredibly proud of in that area.
So as you oversee this foundation, Bridget, what's been a great moment for you? I mean, have you had moments when something happened, a program worked in some way that you will recall as you go forward in your career?
Oh, there are so many that it's hard to pick just one. I would think Tobacco 21 is one to be very proud of. That changed the age of sale and purchase of tobacco from age 18 to age 21.
Something that your foundation worked on.
We did. Some of the public health data coming out that's been evaluated in other communities is already showing a marked reduction in the use of cigarettes by kids. We still have work to do on vaping, but I think we are making progress on that as well. So that would be one item that makes you proud. Certainly, I've been around since the Affordable Care Act went into effect, and we have seen a lot of growth in people being able to explore what insurance means for them, people who are new to the insurance market. I think we've seen a great evolution from just sick care to people thinking about prevention and well-being.
Right.
I think communities
are... Which is a seismic shift in the healthcare world. Yeah.
People are really thinking about, okay, so what does it mean to build a healthy environment? Walkability, sidewalks, bike lanes, stairwells being open in buildings. How do we encourage people at school to be as active as they can be? How do we support a food infrastructure that allows everyone to have access? And I think you're really seeing a shift inside of the health system. Now it's slow to think about how you incorporate the needs of the patient in front of you. How are they part of the care team? How do they help design what well-being means for them? How are we culturally responsive to the variety of people who are coming through our doors?
Meaning fuller engagement from the patients themselves, not just being passive recipients, but active participants, if you will, in the whole process.
And having that be not the exception, but the rule, mm-hmm. and to bring a community into its sense of wellness. And I have to be sure to talk about the enormous health disparities that still exist. For example, Black children are 6 times as likely to die of asthma than white children. We have to do better than that. It is unacceptable that we have that incredible disparity based on race. I think the health system is beginning to think of that, but we've got a long way to go there.
Bridget McCandless is my guest. She's the CEO of the Health Forward Foundation, formerly known as the Healthcare Foundation of Kansas City. You've been practicing medicine since 1992. What kind of medicine did you do early on?
I am an internist, which means that I am an adult medicine specialist. And I found out early on that care of socially complex and vulnerable people was the area that I was was called to work in. Mm-hmm. And that was a very fulfilling career.
I was going to say, in 2000, and you've mentioned this, you co-founded the Jackson County Free Health Clinic. Why did you do that?
It wasn't intentional. I got invited to be part of this project and told them I would do it for a year. And 15 years later, I was still with it because it was the most fulfilling kind of medicine I could provide.
Yeah. You called that your greatest career accomplishment, and I'm wondering why.
I think it allowed me to understand the needs of real people in their social complexity, and it got me ready to do this kind of work. I knew that I could fix them one diabetic at a time, and the legislature could change the rules for tens of thousands of people. So for me, stepping onto a policy stage, being able to think about medicine and health at its more complex level, that was really important for me, but I will be ever grateful for the training that my patients gave me in those early years.
What kind of impact did the HCA, the Affordable Care Act, what impact did that have on healthcare here in the Kansas City area, Bridget?
I would say there is not a single person in this area who is not touched by the Affordable Care Act, whether you realize it or not. My children get to stay on my insurance till they're 26. Every person who has their preventive care paid for with first dollar from your insurance was impacted. Seniors who are able to get their medications. It used to be the big donut hole. If you spent too much money, all of a sudden you were paying all the costs of your medications. All of those seniors were impacted. Anyone who's tried to read your insurance prospectus, that's much simpler now. So there are many aspects that affected the insured population. For states that took up Medicaid expansion, they have seen incredible gains.
You're taking my next question out of my mouth.
Oh.
Yeah.
So those states saw improvement in prevention services, early detection of cancer, people who got their medications filled. They've done well. Their hospital stability, the number of dollars that were going to uncompensated care went down. Missouri and Kansas chose not to do that. So we are two of 14 states who have not chosen to expand Medicaid, which is a grave disappointment because between those two states, we've left 300,000 people behind. That's a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. A huge disappointment then for you.
A missed opportunity. Millions of dollars to come into the area to be able to support uncompensated care and people who got left behind who could have had healthier lives and longer lives. So we squandered the most important thing that we have in our states, which is our people. That's unconscionable.
How frustrating is that for the CEO of the Health Forward Foundation?
It is frustrating, but it is also very clear that access will continue to be a key piece of our conversation and our advocacy for years to come. It is an important aspect of making sure that health belongs to everyone.
Why didn't the HCA, the Affordable Care Act, why didn't that end all of our health care issues?
Oh, health care is one complicated monster.
Mm-hmm.
And while the Affordable Care Act was a complicated piece of legislation, it was also one that was made of compromise. So there were aspects of it that were not perfect. And we would have expected that the Congress would have spent time perfecting it over time. But with our political sticking points, we have not been able to make the improvements that you would have expected in a complicated piece of legislation. I think it made things better. I think there's still plenty of room to go.
Where would you like the foundation to be in 5 years, Bridget? Where does it need to go?
You know, as I talked about health disparities, I think a continued emphasis on equity and being sure that we are thinking about how all peoples have the option to be as well as they can be, that dedicated focus to the vulnerable people of this community is really critical. I also think that helping shift the conversation away from just sickness to health and well-being and having communities thrive is going to be the continued work of the foundation.
How much longer are you going to head the group? What's the timetable here?
I tell people I will be retiring in the fall. They are in the midst of their search for a CEO. I hope that the foundation actually has so many fantastic applicants that that the choice is a hard one. And I have no doubt that a wonderful person will come forward to lead the foundation after I go.
That's Bridget McCandless stepping down as the CEO of the Health Forward Foundation, a leader about to be picked here, hopefully the next few months. Bridget, thanks so much for your thoughts and best of luck with your parents and your future.
Thank you so much for having me.
When we come back, we'll talk about a trailblazing athlete who blazed the way for so many African Americans and hardly anybody's heard of him. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I am Steve Kraske. And did you get my newsletter yesterday? If not, you can sign up to get it next Monday. It'll be the best issue yet. Go to kcur.org/Kraske. There's exclusive insights from me and highlights from the up-to-date team right in your inbox each Monday. It's easy and fast, maybe 10 seconds. Go to kcur.org/Kraske. Tomorrow on the show, Congresswoman Charisse Davids joins me to talk healthcare, infrastructure, gun safety, and a whole lot more. She's been in Kansas while Congress has been on recess, and we'll find out what her constituents are telling her these days. Charisse Davids, tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, when you think of African-American trailblazers in sports, people tend to think of Jackie Robinson and Muhammad Ali and maybe boxer Jack Johnson, for good reason. Less well-known is Major Taylor, who rose to become a national and world champion in cycling. He did it despite rampant racism. In the process, Major Taylor became one of the best chronicled athletes of his time, only to fall into poverty late in life and die at age 53. Michael Cranich is a reporter for The Washington Post who's written a new book on Major Taylor titled The World's Fastest Man, The Extraordinary Life of Cyclist Major Taylor. He'll be in town speaking at the library on Thursday night. He joins us now from the studios of NPR in Washington. Michael, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
How can Major Taylor be one of the most written about athletes ever, at least in his day, and yet I'd never really heard of him?
Well, most people had not heard of him. I had not heard of him when I first became interested 18 years ago.
Okay, back
when
I feel better. Yeah.
I was a reporter for the Boston Globe, and I learned about Major Taylor, who would live much of his life in Worcester, Massachusetts. And I'm a cyclist. I don't race like he did. But I was interested to hear that this man in the 1890s was the first real African-American sports champion. He became the national champion and champion of the world before any other major African-American athlete, before Jack Johnson, who you mentioned, 50 years before Jackie Robinson broke the color line. And what's extraordinary is if you go back and look at the newspaper clippings of the day, you will find he is one of the most chronicled African-American individuals of his time, other than certain civil rights leaders. Cycling at that moment in the 1890s was the most popular sport in the United States.
I was going to say, people don't realize this was a really big deal back in the day, right?
It was an enormous deal. If you wanted to see the future, if you wanted to see speed, put yourself in the time when there's a couple of hundred automobiles in the country. They're experiments. They don't go backwards. They don't have brakes, typically. They're made by bicycle manufacturers. At the same time, there's maybe 5 million bicycles. There are around the country velodromes, these cathedral cycling. They look like today's auto racing tracks, like the Indy 500, and they would draw 10 or 15,000 people at venues all across the country. And at certain points, the cyclists could go 40 miles or more per hour, 40 miles per hour or more. And this was the fastest that anyone really had seen a human go under his or her own power. So, you know, this was far more than the horse and buggy, you know, really before the auto era. So put yourself in that time frame, understanding that cycling was the most popular sport, and you can begin to understand why what happened with Major Taylor becoming, as I call him, the world's fastest man was such an extraordinary moment.
So why isn't he better known today, given his extraordinary accomplishments and contributions when it comes to civil rights?
I think there's several reasons. We don't have audio or film of him that we know of. We don't have cycling as the kind of sport that it was back at that time. People think of cycling, they may think of the Tour de France or a few of the tours in this country. The type of cycling that Major Taylor did, which is basically track cycling, is known to be in the Olympics, but really, although there's some velodromes around the country, it's not a particularly well-known sport. But back at the time he raced, it was an incredibly popular sport. It was basically the main races were dominated by whites. He came along at an extraordinary moment. The major race that I write about where he sort of came to public renown happened in 1896. This was the year of Plessy versus Ferguson, when the Supreme Court ruled by 7-1 that separate accommodations could be equal. Of course, that was racist and not true, but that was the ruling. 7 months after that ruling, here comes Major Taylor. He is going to participate in a race at Madison Square Garden, the country's greatest sportist venue, and he participates in what was called a six-day race because, as it sounds like, you go around the track for 6 days straight, which is extraordinary.
6 days straight, meaning 24 hours a day?
Well, you had an hour off here or there. You could take off the time you wanted, but then you risk losing miles to the competitors. So Major Taylor had a mentor who I write about in some detail named Bertie Munger,
yes,
who himself had been the world's fastest man in the high wheel era. And, you know, he would tell Major Taylor, okay, you've had an hour rest, get back in the track. It was 15 minutes. It was a very, very difficult circumstance to race in. Major Taylor described hallucinating, wandering around the track. They put a pillow on his handlebars at one point. Later, he described, you know, saying, there's someone racing after me with a knife. Wow. You know, it was a very difficult circumstance. Incredibly, I describe this in great detail because it's one of the great moments in sports history as I saw it. He is racing against all of the best riders in the world. All the other riders are white. He had been brought to New York City by his manager, Bertie Munger. He basically had been an amateur racer, but Bertie Munger had seen something in this young man and took him under his wing, appropriately for the nickname of Bertie. And Major Taylor went to the promoters and said, I would like to race against the best racers in the world. And the promoters said, we can't do that. There'll be riots in New York City if a black person races in this race. Major Taylor eventually convinced these promoters, look, if I race, you can promote this as a race of black versus white. It'll draw a lot of attention. And eventually the promoters who wanted to increase turnout saw the light, and they did allow Major Taylor to participate in this race.
Wow.
He raced in a preliminary match of a half mile, incredibly, against the best sprinter in the world, a man named Eddie Bald, whose nickname was Cannonball Bald. He did beat that man, and he won the preliminary match. And then he went on to participate in the six-day race. A lot of racers dropped out. It was so difficult. He managed to survive, stayed in the race for all 6 days, came in eighth place, and that meant he raced 1,700 miles in 6 days. Just for perspective, the Tour de France, which is 3 weeks, that's about 2,200 miles. So can you imagine going for 6 days that amount of miles? It was an extraordinary accomplishment, and he became, very quickly after that, one of the best recognized athletes in the world.
Michael Cranish is my guest. His new book, The World's Fastest Man, The Extraordinary Life of Cyclist Major Taylor. Michael will be speaking about his book at 6:30 Thursday evening at the Plaza branch of the Kansas City Public Library. More information, kclibrary.org. You know, just to give our listeners some perspective on how important cycling was in Major Taylor's time, you point out there were 30,000 bicycle shops across the country back in those days. 30,000.
I mean, this was the bicycle craze. The middle of the 1890s, as I mentioned earlier, a few hundred cars, 5 million bicycles. There were bicycle manufacturing plants across the country, shops everywhere. Even small cities had numerous shops. You know, this was like you think today of automobiles. Suddenly, everyone wanted a bicycle. It was freedom. So for women, you know, it was liberation. One of the women who wrote a book about the suffrage movement titled her autobiography, How I Learned to Ride the Bicycle. So for women, it was freedom. For African Americans who were being banned from, you know, various places under Jim Crow restrictions, this was another way to get around. This was freedom for them as well. And just for the average individual, you know, just like when you ride a bicycle today and you sort of feel this wonderful sense of liberation, you know, it had that, you know, in many different variations of that world. So, you know, yes, bicycles were incredibly popular, and going to see a bicycle race was the thing to do at the time.
You know, there's photographs in the book of him, and I'm wondering, the late 1800s era of Major Taylor, and that wasn't long past the time when you had those really old-fashioned bicycles with the little tiny wheel in the back and the big giant wheel up front. So I'm wondering, how advanced were the bicycles of Major Taylor's time when he was racing, Michael?
Well, it's a great question. The high wheel era, those bicycles were very difficult to ride, so really a trained rider could ride them great distances, but the average person didn't ride those very much. And then along came what was known as the safety bicycle, because they had equal-sized wheels. If you look at them, they're not much different from today's bicycles.
Yes, that's what struck me about it.
And Taylor's manager, Bertie Munger, who I mentioned, he made some of the lightest, most sophisticated bicycles of the time. He was building bicycles basically for those who wanted to race, and he gave one of the great state-of-the-art bicycles to Major Taylor. So Major Taylor had the benefit of riding, you know, a very lightweight. It was described at the time as 14 pounds. If you know cycling, you know, that's on a par with today's, you know, very sophisticated bicycles. It really is extraordinary. I had to triple check. Could that really be right? And I was assured by historians that it was, for various reasons that I describe in the book. So he was racing a sophisticated bike, had the best trainer in the world. And he, if you look at the pictures, You'll see as a 15-year-old, he looked like a scrawny kid. He was 5'7" at his tallest, 150 pounds or so. Typically in the sport he was in, you were a much bigger, stronger individual. He refined his training and his eating habits to a scientific degree. If you look at the picture a couple of years later, he looks like one of the fittest individuals on the planet, and he probably was as an athlete. Very muscular, very strong. He wrote that he felt that if he was an ounce over or underweight, that he would lose his competitive edge. So if you read, and I put in the back an appendix of his training methods, if you read about what he did, it really is like today's methods. He would eat prodigious quantities of eggs to get massive amount of protein into his body. A lot of people at the time, they ate tons of carbohydrates, didn't focus on protein. They drank beer. They did all sorts of things that were not good for racing. Taylor studied the most sophisticated methods that he could, and he made himself into the most competitive athlete that he possibly could so he could take on bigger, stronger individuals and win race after race.
If you want to join our conversation about Major Taylor, our guest is Michael Cranish, again, the author of a new book on him. Our phone number, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. You know, I can't help but wonder how arduous it was for Major Taylor to compete against a field of all white men. And what he endured in the process of that. Can you give us a sense of the racist opposition he faced as a competitor in the cycling field?
He did face incredible racist obstacles. All of the racers in the typical racing venues that I write about in the book, they were typically white. He occasionally faced other black racers, and there were some races just for blacks. But typically, he was going against an all-white field, and this was a profession that if you were at the top of the field, you would win $10,000 a year or more in winnings in the 1890s, early 1900s. That's a lot of money, you know, back at that time. And they began to fear that Major Taylor was so good, he was cutting into their winnings. So there were numerous instances where they banned him, or they tried to ban him, or they threatened him. If you look at Major Taylor's scrapbooks that I was able to do for research for the book, there are many stories. The headlines are things like Major Taylor's life is threatened, Major Taylor is beaten. There is a circumstance in Massachusetts at the track where an individual choked Taylor to such a degree he lay senseless on the track for about 5 minutes until he was revived. Things got so bad that Bertie Munger, his manager, convinced Major Taylor to let a lotion be applied to him that was advertised in a racist way at the time.
Yeah,
this lotion was advertised as something that was a skin-lightening lotion, that it could make you look almost white. And Taylor was being banned from so many races that he eventually agreed to let his skin go under this treatment, which was a very painful treatment. It was like an acidic lotion. And for several days, they applied this. The skin did look a little bit lighter, but it was so painful that they stopped this treatment. And Major Taylor saw this as a turning point. He would never again let someone try to treat him as if he was someone other than who he was. He used the racism against him as the motivation, and it spurred him on to some of his greatest victories.
I was going to say, where did this determination come from, Michael, for Major Taylor to not only endure this, but to triumph over it? I mean, why put up with it?
Well, my conclusion is that Major Taylor saw himself as someone who had this incredible ability, and he wanted to prove to the country that if an African-American was given a fair shake, as he put it, an equal chance to compete, that that individual could succeed as well as anyone. All he wanted, he said, was a fair chance to compete against the best. And then he would work as hard to overcome the adversity and persevere, and he could succeed. And he wrote that if an individual was given this in any field of human endeavor, as he said, then they could succeed. All that was needed was a fair shake. So he did this not just for his own personal glory, but because he knew because of his great athletic talent that he could make a larger point for society at a time when racism was growing. The Civil War was over. Reconstruction basically was failing. More restrictions were coming in due to the Plessy versus Ferguson ruling that basically institutionalized Jim Crow. And here's this man coming along, Major Taylor, who's basically disproving all of these theories, holding up a lot. It was a lot of weight on his shoulders to maintain this, but he felt a responsibility not just to himself and his family, but to the African-American race as a whole.
So he had a dual set of motivations. He wanted to be a champion, but he also wanted to prove to the world that African-Americans were indeed not inferior.
Right. And that's in the best tradition of athletics. Athletics, you know, especially now we think about athletes, they get paid millions of dollars and so forth. This was a time period when, you know, he was in the greatest tradition, showing that you could use athletics for the greatest possible purpose, a public purpose, if you will. And he did that time and again. He became, for a lot of reporters who followed him, they recognized that. He became, in our parlance, you know, a good story. And when he competed around the world, he was very much sought after. If you look at the coverage of him, and I have chapters about his competitions in France, for example. He was extraordinarily chronicled. He was on the cover of newspapers, cover of magazines. His rise coincided with a new era of photography that enabled you to capture live motion sports. So while there's no film we know of, there's incredible photos taken by French photographers that I include in the book. So he just, you know, he was adulated. He was written about in racist ways, but also in very admiring ways by various sectors of the press. And if you read those stories, you got a different sense about African-Americans if you've just been reading a lot of the racist press that was so predominant.
You know, you point out here that Major Taylor was a man of two worlds, raised first by his poor family of black farmers. Let's begin with them. Tell us about them.
Well, Major Taylor's father fought for the Civil War on the North. I spent a lot of time trying to figure out exactly what happened. And the bottom line is that his father, Gilbert, did serve for the North and was there at the fall of Richmond when the North won the Civil War, and then came back to Kentucky where they had lived, moved to Indianapolis, and that's where Major Taylor was born. Major Taylor's father had worked for an individual, a white man who worked for the railroad company. That white man had a son about Major Taylor's age, and Major Taylor became that son's playmate. The son liked to ride a bicycle. They got Major Taylor a bicycle. And Major Taylor later said it was like growing up the son of a millionaire because he spent so much time with that family. So, yes, he was living with his poor farming family in Indianapolis, but also living, you know, quite a luxurious life, if you will, seeing another side of things with this other family. However, racism persisted. He went to the local YMCA to train, and he was turned back. The Indianapolis YMCA told him, "You can't enter through our doors because of your skin color." And this was the first time Major Taylor became aware of what he later called the, quote, monster prejudice. So he did see that, and eventually, with the person who became his manager, Bertie Munger, moved to Worcester, Massachusetts, where he lived most of the rest of his life.
Hey, how much insight were you able to get as a researcher about Major Taylor and how he thought and how he perceived the world as he was going through it? Was there much to fall back on?
Well, there was. I had the good fortune in 2001, when I wrote a magazine story of Major Taylor for the Boston Globe, to meet Major Taylor's daughter, Sydney, who was then 96 years old and living in Pittsburgh.
Yes.
So I spent time with her and the family. The daughter had given all of Major Taylor's scrapbooks to a museum in Indianapolis, so I was able to read through all those scrapbooks. As well, there was a year of letters that Major Taylor wrote to his wife from Paris. Those were really revealing, and they really helped me understand his thinking in real time. Major Taylor did write an autobiography, but it's not quite the same level of revelation as these letters to his wife were, as you might imagine. Taylor, in his autobiography, was describing a lot of races, things that we wouldn't know about today. He included a lot of newspaper clippings. Those letters, to me, were a goldmine because he really, there, some of them are 15 pages long, and they really did reveal his innermost feelings, his fears, his hopes, his dreams to his wife. They had a young child who had stayed behind as well. So those were wonderful. Also, Major Taylor gave many, many interviews to the press around the world. He competed not just in this country, but in France and throughout Europe and two seasons in Australia. So many of the best interviews were conducted by foreign press because they really wanted to ask about things in America. A lot of the American reporters wanted to ask about minute details of racing. I write a lot about, you know, the races in the book, but I really wanted to use Major Taylor as a lens to understand this intersection of the Jim Crow era and the Gilded Age. So a lot of what I write about is him, you know, walking through this history. So that, to me, was one of the joys of writing the book, having his story and being able to put myself back in that time period. And then whenever he wrote about a certain day or a city or a period, I could then research what was happening in that area at that time to hopefully bring it to life, not just make it a story about this race and that race, but to really give you a sense of that time period in which he was living, which was so important for our nation's history.
You know, Michael, the end of his life wasn't all that great. I'm wondering what happened to him.
Well, it is a sad ending. He did go into poverty. He spent many thousands of dollars trying to become an auto business leader, and he spent about $15,000 on an auto tire business, for example. It should have been very successful. His family believes that for some racist reasons that other people took advantage of his patents. He basically had an idea for a steel belted tire that was ahead of his time, for example. He also gave away a lot of money to his family, to his church, to charities. And things did fall apart. He separated from his wife. He was writing an autobiography called The Fastest Bicycle Rider in the World in the 1920s. He eventually had to get that essentially self-published, and things became so bad he had to give up his house in Worcester, Massachusetts. He moved to Chicago, lived at a YMCA there, and he did die there in poverty, and he was buried in a pauper's grave. Later on, African-American athletes and others did recognize that he needed to be recognized again, and they had him buried with a proper marker in 1948. And since then, there have been efforts to rehabilitate him, to tell his story. Other people have written about him, and I really try in this book to do him justice for the period of time. So he wanted his message to be, as I mentioned earlier, to be remembered as someone who persevered, if given a fair shake, that he could show that any individual, regardless of skin color, could triumph.
You know, did people, you know, like Jackie Robinson, like Muhammad Ali, like Jesse Jackson, for that matter, did those people ever recognize him publicly and acknowledge what Major Taylor had been able to do?
Well, yes. I'll tell you a story I came across during the research for this book that tells you a lot. Jack Johnson, who a lot of people think of as perhaps the first African-American world champion.
Right.
He initially wanted to be a cyclist like Major Taylor. He wanted to emulate
him. Yeah, I was really struck by that, yeah. But he thought cycling was too dangerous, though.
Right. He said, well, what happened was he got in a crash in a race in Texas, and he was hospitalized with some severe wounds. And he said, you know, I need to go in a less dangerous sport, boxing. So he became the world champion boxer in 1908, and that was 9 years after Major Taylor had become the world champion in 1899. So, you know, it just shows you, I mean, yes, they did follow, and I'm very confident if we were talking on the phone, if this was like a Field of Dreams, you know, interview where we had Jack Johnson and Jesse Owens and Jackie Robinson, they would agree that Major Taylor paved the way.
I was wondering, when you interviewed Major Taylor's daughter, Michael, to what extent was she thrilled that someone like you was coming to talk to her about her dad, who had been lost to history?
Well, I think she was grateful. There, I wasn't the first person to talk to her. She had been interviewed, you know, by some others. At 96, she was completely able to tell me, you know, her recollections. She remembered, for example, being in the stands in Paris as a young girl, watching her father and cheering for him. So she took great pride. The story was told to me later that there would be people coming by her house, you know, wanting to talk about Major Taylor, wanting to see his scrapbooks. And eventually, you know, she said, you know, I need to put this in a public place where researchers in the future can go and learn about his story. So thank goodness she did that, because I went there at the time in 2001. And then last year when I was finishing the research, I went back and went through all of the scrapbooks and letters again, postcards, all sorts of things that were provided by her to the museum. And, you know, it really comes to life. You can really feel it when you hold those letters in your hand. It was one thing to see things online, but another thing to actually hold those documents and feel the paper that he felt and appreciate, you know, all that he went through, the incredible racism he faced, somehow managing at a period when it was just so extraordinarily difficult, and in a way that still has relevance today, triumphing over those great odds.
Michael Cranish's book, The World's Fastest Man, The Extraordinary Life of Cyclist Major Taylor, America's First Black Sports Hero. Again, he'll speak at 6:30 Thursday evening at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City Public Library. More information, kclibrary.org. Michael, enjoy the conversation. Thanks so much for taking some time.
Thanks for having me.
Tomorrow on the show, jailing a parent for unpaid child support seems counterproductive. But what other options do judges have? We'll find out. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Elizabeth Ruiz. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.